Org and is narrated by Emma Thompson. It examines just how close humanity has come to nuclear catastrophe and why Ellsberg's decades-long warnings about nuclear policy and power remain urgently relevant today. We ran out of time in that conversation, so we're very glad to welcome Paul Jay back to the show to pick up where we left off. Today, we'll continue our discussion about the ongoing nuclear threat, how it's shaped by political and corporate interests, and what the public needs to understand in order to push for meaningful change. In addition to his work as a journalist and filmmaker, Paul Jay is the founder of TheAnalysis.News. For decades, he has investigated the inner workings of government, corporate power, and military policy, bringing together deep investigative reporting with a storyteller's clarity, helping audiences make sense of complex and often hidden forces that shape our world. Paul Jay, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Happy to be back.
Great. Well, before I get into questions, on February 5th, that signaled the end of the New START Treaty. Can you just very briefly, before we get into our other questions, let listeners know what that means?
Well, in some ways, it's more symbolic than anything. The New START Treaty, which limited the numbers of nuclear weapons Russia and the United States had, and was more or less effective in reducing numbers.
I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I came to America looking for freedom and freedom of speech, freedom of everything, you know what I mean? To be held here in this place for saying free Palestine, ceasefire now. That was like a kind of a shock to me, because that's not the America that I heard of.
Calls are growing for the Trump administration to release Lekha Cordia, who's been held by ICE for nearly a year. She was recently hospitalized after suffering a seizure, the first of her life. She was detained after taking part in pro-Palestine protests at Columbia University. We'll speak with her attorney. Then, the Alabama solution.
I want to tell you that your son was murdered. They sweep stuff underneath the rug all the time.
If you're an inmate in Alabama prison, you're probably praying every night that nothing bad happens to you. It's dangerous and volatile. It could explode at any moment.
I mean, it's corrupt. That's all you can say.
What do we finish with? Film me. Why?
A stunning new documentary takes viewers inside what's been described as America's deadliest prison system. The Oscar-nominated film is based on footage secretly recorded on cell phones by prisoners locked up in Alabama. Some of the men featured in the film were recently sent to solitary confinement. We'll speak to the film's co-directors, Andrew Jarecki and Charlotte Kaufman, and a lawyer in Alabama who represents some of the men featured in the film, The Alabama Solution. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. military is planning for possible strikes on Iran that could last for weeks if President Trump orders the attack. That's according to two U.S. officials speaking to Reuters. It comes amidst a CBS News report that President Trump informed Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu during his meeting at Mar-a-Lago in December that the U.S. would back Israeli strikes against Iran's ballistic missile program if the U.S. can't reach a deal with Iran. Meanwhile, in an interview with the BBC, Iran's deputy foreign minister, Majid Takhravanshi, said his country is willing to make compromises to reach a nuclear deal with the U.S. in exchange for the lifting of sanctions. On Saturday, 250,000 people rallied in Germany on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference, protesting against Iran's government following a call from Iran's exiled Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi. At the conference, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham called for regime change in Iran.
If we back out now, it'll be the biggest mistake we've made, far worse than the Syrian red line, far worse than Afghanistan. You can't say, keep protesting, we got you back, help's on the way, and nothing happened. That's why I am confident that President Trump will get an outcome consistent with those three statements through diplomacy or military force.
Israeli forces have killed at least 11 Palestinians in Gaza over the past 24 hours. Since the U.S. brokered ceasefire last October, Israel's killed over 600 Palestinians and wounded over 1,600, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. This is Alian Al-Bayouk, whose son was killed in Israeli airstrikes.
Do you believe there's a board of peace? Do you believe that Trump will come to help us or defend us? The one who's supplying Israel with all sorts of deadly weapons, supplying it with money, with political support, with protection, and with an international umbrella. Do you believe that there is peace that Trump or someone else would provide for us?
On Sunday, President Trump announced members of his so-called Board of Peace have pledged $5 billion towards rebuilding Gaza. Indonesia's military said it's committing up to 8,000 troops to be deployed in Gaza by the end of June. Meanwhile, Doctors Without Borders, Medecins Sans Frontières, known as MSF, has halted some of its non-essential medical operations at Nasser Hospital in Gaza after staff and patients reported seeing armed men inside the facility. Since the October 10th ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, the organization says, quote, MSF teams have reported a pattern of unacceptable acts, including the presence of armed men, intimidation, arbitrary arrests of patients, and a recent situation of suspicion of movement of weapons, unquote. Last month, Israel ordered MSF and 30 other international groups to cease operations in Gaza and the occupied West Bank if they did not agree to new rules that include sharing information about staff. Doctors Without Borders says it did not submit a list of its staffers in Gaza since Israel could not guarantee their safety. In the occupied West Bank, the Oscar-winning Palestinian director of No Other Land says his family has been attacked again by Israeli settlers, leaving his brother hospitalized and four members of his family arrested by the Israeli army. Hamdan Bilal says the violence began on Sunday when Israeli settlers began attacking his family's home in the village of Susya. Bilal says the settlers' raid was led by the same man who previously attacked him last March, injuring his head and stomach after Bilal's film made global headlines for winning an Academy Award. Bilal says his brother called police only to have soldiers from the Israeli army raid the home, attacking everyone inside. The violence came hours after Israel's government approved a plan to allow land registration in the West Bank for the first time since 1967, paving the way for Israel to annex Palestinian lands. Israeli human rights groups warn the land registration process will facilitate the dispossession and displacement of Palestinians in violation of international law. A U.S. military strike killed three people and blew up a boat in the Caribbean Friday, according to U.S. Southern Command. The U.S. military said the boat was allegedly following drug trafficking routes, unquote, without providing any evidence. Since September, the Pentagon's conducted 39 strikes against boats they say are smuggling drugs in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific, killing at least 133 people, again without providing evidence. On Sunday, the Pentagon announced U.S. forces raided a sanctioned oil tanker in the Indian Ocean after tracking the vessel in the Caribbean in an effort to target oil shipped from Venezuela. The Trump administration's been seizing tankers in order to take control of Venezuela's oil. It comes as the Wall Street Journal reports the Pentagon used Anthropic's artificial intelligence tool Claude in its operation to abduct Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. The Pentagon was able to use Claude through Anthropic's partnership with the data company Palantir. A spokesman for Anthropic told the Wall Street Journal the company's, quote, committed to using frontier AI in support of U.S. national security, unquote. In southwestern Russia, Ukrainian drone strikes set off fires at the Black Sea port of Taman on Sunday, an attack that wounded two people and damaged an oil storage tanker, warehouse, and terminals. Elsewhere, debris from Russian drones damaged infrastructure in Ukraine's Odessa region, disrupting water and electricity supplies to civilians. The violence comes ahead of a new round of U.S. brokered talks involving Russian and Ukrainian envoys who will meet in Geneva Tuesday and Wednesday. Meanwhile, a report by UK and European nations issued Saturday finds Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny's death in a Siberian penal colony in 2024 was likely due to a deadly toxin found in the skin of Ecuadorian poison dart frogs. The toxin was reportedly found in smuggled samples taken from Navalny's body. Democratic Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio offered contrasting visions of America's role in the world at the Munich Security Conference in Germany over the weekend. Congressmember Ocasio-Cortez sharply criticized U.S. foreign policy and tied rising income inequality to authoritarianism around the world.
They are looking to withdraw the United States from the entire world so that we can turn into an age of authoritarianisms, of authoritarians that can carve out the world where Donald Trump can command the Western Hemisphere and Latin America as his personal sandbox, where Putin can saber rattle around Europe and try to bully around our own allies there, and for essentially authoritarians to have their own geographic domains.
Meanwhile, Secretary of State Marco Rubio cast immigration as an existential threat to both Europe and the U.S.
In the pursuit of a world without borders, we opened our doors to an unprecedented wave of mass migration that threatens the cohesion of our societies, the continuity of our culture, and the future of our people. We made these mistakes together. And now, together, we owe it to our people to face those facts and to move forward to rebuild.
The Trump administration's planning to spend more than $38 billion to acquire warehouses across the U.S. in order to retrofit them into new ICE jails with capacity for tens of thousands of prisoners. 16 large buildings will be converted into regional processing centers, jailing more than 1,000 immigrants at a time, with a further 8 large detention centers capable of holding 7 to 10,000 prisoners for an average of 2 months. That's according to documents first revealed by the Washington Post. This comes as a Reuters review found hundreds of judges around the United States have ruled more than 4,400 times since October that President Trump's administration is detaining immigrants unlawfully. Yet the administration's continued jailing people indefinitely, even after courts rule the policy is illegal. In Minnesota, 2 ICE agents have been suspended and face a criminal investigation into whether they lied to a jury about shooting a Venezuelan immigrant last month. The officers claimed Julio Cesar Sosa Celis and his cousin, Alfredo Alejandro Aljorno, attacked them with a snow shovel and a broom after a traffic stop on January 14th, and said one of the officers fired in self-defense. Shortly after the shooting, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem described it as, quote, an attempted murder of federal law enforcement, unquote. But video evidence directly contradicts claims the men attacked federal agents. So Cicelli says he had retreated into his home and was shot in the leg while in the process of closing and locking the door. On Thursday, a federal judge dismissed felony assault charges against the cousins after the U.S. attorney in Minneapolis said newly discovered evidence had contradicted the officer's testimony, and after ICE admitted the federal agents made false statements under oath. The Department of Homeland Security entered a partial shutdown early Saturday morning after Senate Democrats refused to support a DHS funding bill. They're pressuring Republicans to agree to tighter controls on immigration enforcement, including requiring federal agents to wear identification, get judicial warrants to enter private property, and to stop wearing masks. About 90% of the more than 260,000 employees at DHS are deemed essential workers, meaning they'll be required to work, though they could miss paychecks if the shutdown lasts for weeks. That includes nearly 60,000 airport security workers with the TSA and nearly 20,000 staff at the Federal Emergency Management Agency, known as FEMA. A federal judge has ordered the Trump administration to return Babson College student Ani Lucia Lopez Beosa to the United States after she was wrongfully deported to Honduras in November. At the time, Lopez Beosa was trying to fly from Boston to her home in Houston, Texas, to surprise her family for Thanksgiving. She was told there was an issue with her boarding pass at the gate before she was detained by federal immigration agents. She was taken to Texas and deported to Honduras 2 days later, despite a court order blocking her removal while her case was pending. Judge Richard Stearns has given the Trump administration 2 weeks to facilitate Annie's return to the United States. His order comes after a federal prosecutor admitted in January ICE had mistakenly deported her. Healthcare advocates are calling on Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to resign after he downplayed the risks of COVID-19 by saying he, quote, used to snort cocaine off of toilet seats, unquote. RFK Jr. made the remark in an interview with the podcaster Theo Vaughn.
I'm not scared of a germ. You know, I used to snort cocaine off of toilet seats.
Protect Our Care said in response, quote, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. continues to lay bare why he's the most dangerous, in over his head, ill-suited person ever to lead such an important federal agency that has life and death power, unquote. This comes after the Food and Drug Administration last week blocked review of a flu vaccine developed by Moderna using the same mRNA technology that led to the rapid development of vaccines against COVID. The review was blocked by Vinay Prasad, a vaccine skeptic hand-picked by RFK Jr. last May to lead the division of the FDA that oversees vaccine regulation. Former President Barack Obama has responded publicly to a racist video shared on social media by President Trump, which depicts the Obamas as apes. In a podcast hosted by Brian Tyler Cohen and published on Saturday, Barack Obama refused to directly address the video, but said many people, quote, find this behavior deeply disturbing.
There's this sort of clown show that's happening in social media and on television. And what is true is that there doesn't seem to be any shame about this.
Although the White House took down the video after about 12 hours, President Trump refused to apologize for sharing it. The Senate's only black Republican, Tim Scott, said, quote, it's the most racist thing I've seen out of this White House, unquote. Reuters is reporting the director of the White House Office of Management and Budget, Russell Vogt, is using $15 million of what remains of USAID's operating expenses to fund his security detail. A source tells Reuters Vogt's detail includes more than a dozen U.S. marshals. Russ Vogt is the chief architect of Project 2025, which outlined the Trump administration's plans to downsize federal agencies and fire thousands of federal workers. Last year, the Trump administration dismantled USAID, canceled most of its aid programs around the world, and fired about 10,000 workers. The Trump administration's decision to shut down USAID resulted resulted in hundreds of thousands of deaths from infectious diseases and malnutrition around the world. And in California, thousands of San Francisco public school workers ended their strike Friday after 4 days on the picket line. United Educators of San Francisco announced a tentative agreement with the school district that included fully funded health care starting in 2027 and higher wages. The union represents some 6,000 teachers, librarians, social workers, and nurses from more than 100 schools across San Francisco. It was the city's first teacher strike in nearly half a century. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now! democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, calls are growing for the Trump administration to release La Concordia. She's been jailed by ICE for nearly a year, was recently hospitalized after suffering a seizure. She was detained after taking part in pro-Palestine protests at Columbia University. Stay with us. Mata tarat mahata Dirs rat duvita idaya Khele sagal jagata Khele sagal jagata Sunny Singh in our Democracy Now! Studio. On Monday, February 23rd, Democracy Now! Will be celebrating our 30th anniversary at the historic Riverside Church in New York. Guests will include Sunny Singh, Angela Davis, Naomi Klein, Maria Ressa, Michael Stipe, Wynton Marsalis, Masaba Butoha, V, Hooray for the Riff Raff, and more. Go to democracynow.org for more information. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show looking at growing demands for the release of La Concordia. She's a 33-year-old Palestinian woman who's been in ICE detention for nearly a year. She was arrested during the 2024 Gaza Solidarity protests at Columbia University, but the charges were later dropped. Then, last March, Cordia was detained at an ICE check-in in Newark, New Jersey. Federal immigration officers said her student visa had expired. She's been jailed at ICE's Prairieland Detention Facility in North Texas since. She's the only person who remains in detention from the Columbia-Gaza Solidarity mobilizations. La Concordia recently suffered a seizure in the ICE jail. She was hospitalized for 3 days with her family and legal team desperately searching for her, while ICE refused to share information about her whereabouts. In a statement released by her legal team, La Concordia said her hands and legs were shackled the entire time she was hospitalized, including when she went to the bathroom. "I felt like an animal," she said. Lacar writes in the statement, quote, "The hospital told me I was more prone to seizures because of poor sleep, inadequate nutrition, and stress. The doctor advised me to reduce my stress and eat food to avoid a future seizure. I don't know how I can do that while I'm confined," she said. She went on, "At Prairieland, your daily life, whether you can have access to the food or medicine you need or even a good night's sleep, is controlled by the private for-profit business that runs this facility." She said, "We live in filthy conditions. The best medicine for me and everyone else here is our freedom." She concluded, "The only reason ICE targeted me in the first place is because I protested against the Israeli government's genocide in Gaza. Even now, U.S.-made bombs continue to destroy Palestinian homes and kill Palestinian families." Those were the words of La Concordia. In December, NPR's Radio Diaries aired part of a phone call between Cordia and her cousin Hamza Abu Shaban, who's been in touch with her regularly throughout her detention.
I received a call from my mother telling me there are people asking for you from the government. At the beginning, I thought like they're missing a form or something. Okay, I'm just going to solve this issue and then like I'll have my green card soon. But they took my my fingerprints and all that. They said, you're going to Texas. I said, Texas? Like, that's really far away. And when I arrived to Texas, the place was overcrowded.
How many people are there with you?
So right now we're 87. And the capacity of this place is 37. It's a lot of people sleeping on the floor.
Wow.
Yeah. Maybe another word to describe this place, a big bathroom. It's open. Everything is open. There is no privacy.
The Department of Homeland Security's refused to release Lekha Cordia on bond despite multiple court orders. Last week, New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani wrote, quote, online, La Concordia has spent nearly a year in an ICE prison for exercising her First Amendment rights in NYC and speaking out against the ongoing genocide in Palestine. She was hospitalized after suffering a seizure. Now she's back in detention. This is cruel and unnecessary. Release Lekha now, Mayor Mamdani wrote. For more, we're joined by Sarah Sherman Stokes, Lekha Cordia's immigration attorney. She's associate director and clinical associate professor at the Boston University School of Law. Sarah, thanks so much for being with us. Lekha Cordia has been in prison for almost a year, has been in an ICE jail. Tell us about the circumstances, about her being hospitalized, about you and the family not being able to find her when she was first hospitalized. Please give us the details.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for those questions. Lekha Cordia is a young woman. She is a daughter. She is a sister. She is a cousin. She is a devout woman of faith. Her faith is very important to her. She's a proud Palestinian woman. Hearing her voice at the top of the hour and again now, I'm reminded also what an advocate she is. And so I think it's important to start with that. Despite that, unfortunately, on Friday, February 7th, Lekha had a seizure. This was on the heels of being sick, of months of malnutrition and poor conditions at the Prairie Land Detention Center. She has a seizure. She was taken to the hospital. The family was alerted by someone who had been formerly detained at Prairie Land. The women inside, they look out for each other, and Lekha is no exception. She is constantly advocating for the other women inside. But Lekha was rushed to the hospital, and for 72 hours, we did not know where she was. The legal team and her family put in repeated calls and emails to ICE. We were ignored. The emails went unanswered. Ultimately, ICE told us that it would be a safety issue if they were to reveal either her condition or her whereabouts, which was sort of a bewildering statement because shortly thereafter, ICE revealed to a reporter where Lekha was being kept, or where she was hospitalized. We only found out where she was through that reporter. But through it all, we had no idea whether she was, frankly, whether she was alive or dead. This has been the deadliest time for people in ICE detention since President Trump took office for a second time. 36 people have died in ICE custody, and we were worried that Lekha would be 37.
This is her first seizure, the one that she had in jail?
That's correct. This is the first seizure she's ever had in her life. In fact, she's been a relatively healthy person physically until she was detained by ICE nearly a year ago. In ICE custody, unsurprisingly, her health has deteriorated significantly. She's lost weight. She's been unable to eat. Her repeated requests for halal food have been denied. She's forced to live on snacks from the commissary, which depends on her family providing her basically a weekly allowance so that she can supplement her calories, because the food that they provide at the facility is inedible and also doesn't conform to her dietary needs. So she has been really unwell, as have many other women in that detention facility.
Let's go back to hear more of Lakah Cordia in her own words. In this excerpt from NPR's radio diary, she talked about the charges she faces and how ICE has appealed her release.
The charges were only about immigration. So if it's only about immigration, I'm fine. I'm going to be out very soon. The judge ruled that I should be released. And ICE appealed the same day, saying that I'm dangerous. I went for a protest and all that. The second time, the judge ruled immediate release again. And again, ICE appealed the same day. It just like a slap on the face. Because I came to America looking for freedom and freedom of speech, freedom of everything. You know what I mean? To be held here in this place for saying free Palestine, ceasefire now. That was like a kind of a shock to me, because that's not the America that I heard of.
So that's Lakah Cordia in her own words. Again, in the New York Times, a judge twice ruling she's not a threat to the U.S. and could be released on a $20,000 bond. You told the New York Times government lawyers have twice filed a rarely used provision known as an automatic stay, which keeps a person detained during the appeals process. So what can get Lakah out?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Lakah has been, as you said, Lakah has been ordered released twice by the immigration judge. The government has all but completely abandoned any argument that she is a danger to persons or property. And the judge found that any risk of flight would be ameliorated by a $20,000 bond. Her family has been ready and willing and able to pay that bond. And as you mentioned, the government has twice invoked this automatic stay provision to keep her detained while we appeal. Her legal team recently filed a status request request for a status conference in federal court so that we can get her case again in front of a different judge again argue for her release. Lakah should never have been detained, and she certainly should not be detained nearly 1 year later, especially not following this seizure. Her health is at great risk if she remains in custody.
And can you explain on what grounds the government is holding her? Tricia McLaughlin, spokesperson for DHS, said Ms. Cordia has been found to be providing financial support to individuals living in nations hostile to the U.S.
Yes, the Department of Homeland Security in this case has argued that sending remittances to beloved family members is somehow a danger or against the law. There is no law that forbids people in the United States from sending remittances, sending what little money they've saved up to their beloved family members abroad. Tens of thousands of immigrants do this every day across the United States, and Lakah is no different. She's lost more than 200 members of her family to the genocide in Gaza, and what little money she was able to save working as a waitress in Paterson, New Jersey, she sent to family members whose houses and businesses had been bombed by the Israeli military. She did what all of us would do to support our family members who are struggling. And the government has tried to weaponize that and use it against her, but they've been unsuccessful. The immigration judge saw right through that argument and ordered her release on bail, notwithstanding that argument by the government.
Where could the Trump administration deport her to, Sarah Sherman-Stokes?
So the government has argued that she should be removed to Israel. The judge found that she would be persecuted in Israel and actually granted her something called withholding of removal, saying that it would not be safe for her to be sent back to Israel because it is more likely than not that she would be persecuted there. The government is now appealing that ruling, and so the litigation continues on the merits of her case.
Has Colombia weighed in, even if she wasn't a student there?
To my knowledge, Colombia has not weighed in. On one level, find that unsurprising. They haven't weighed in to support or defend, any or at least not many of the folks that have been arrested at the protests and mobilizations there. Lakah is like so many others, like Mahmoud Khalil, like Rumeza Ozturk, like many others who have spoken out for Palestine, who have called for an end to the genocide, who have called for a ceasefire. She's exercising her constitutionally protected free speech rights. But no, I don't see Colombia standing up to support her.
Finally, where exactly is she being held now?
She remains back at the Prairie Land Detention Center in Alvarado, Texas, where she is being held with hundreds of other people, including the women in her sort of dorm or bunk area, many of whom have ongoing and chronic health conditions just like her. And as she said in her press release, in her own words, this story isn't just about her. This story is about the many other women and men and people who are also confined in ICE custody and whose stories aren't being told. They too should be free.
Sarah Sherman Stokes, I want to thank you for being with us. She is the immigration lawyer for LaCa Cordia, associate director and clinical associate professor at the Boston University School of Law. Coming up, the Oscar-nominated Alabama Solution, a stunning new documentary taking viewers inside what's been described as America's deadliest prison system. Based on footage secretly recorded on cell phones by prisoners locked up in Alabama. We'll speak with the film's directors and a lawyer in Alabama who represents some of the men featured in the Alabama Solution. Stay with us. Sunny Singh in our Democracy Now! Studio. On Monday, February 23rd, Democracy Now! Will be celebrating our 30th anniversary at the historic Riverside Church here in New York. Sunny Singh will be playing at the reception, and those in the program are Angela Davis, Naomi Klein, the Nobel laureate Maria Ressa, the singer-songwriter Michael Stipe, jazz legend Wynton Marsalis, the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Masab Abu-Toha, and more. See democracynow.org for more information. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to The Alabama Solution, the Oscar-nominated documentary that takes viewers inside what's been described as America's deadliest prison system. The film based on footage secretly recorded on cell phones by prisoners locked up in Alabama. Some of them featured in the film were recently sent to solitary confinement. This is the film's trailer.
I know you're grieving, but I want to tell you that your son was murdered. They sweep stuff underneath the rug all the time.
If you're an inmate in Alabama prison, you're probably praying every night that nothing bad happens to you. It's dangerous and volatile. It could explode at any moment.
I mean, it's corrupt. That's all you can say. It happens.
Finished.
What are we finished with?
Film me.
Why?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hold on a minute. Police in here.
Oh, okay.
Don't talk.
We have record numbers of people leaving out of here in body bags. They don't want the public to see what's really going on their inside.
How can a journalist go into a war zone but can't go into a prison in the United States of America?
The state is settling one lawsuit after another. There's no consequences for their actions.
It's not the inmate that's killing them folks. It's the guards.
There's an argument that there is some systemic problem within all of our facilities, and I wholeheartedly disagree with that.
How can you defend this?
One guard, he knew something. I could tell he was a liar.
We are going to pursue it based on the facts to the fullest extent that we're allowed.
Their biggest fear is to see us come together on one accord. We got to take our power back.
We have to come together and make a stand that our life is worth something.
I came to prison in 1985. I know what you folks are doing.
We have been taking life and death risk to get this information out, but we still can.
That's the trailer to The Alabama Solution, the HBO original documentary available to stream now on HBO Max. We're joined by three guests. Tiffany Johnson Cole is with us, civil rights and civil litigation attorney in Mobile, Alabama. She's a childhood friend and attorney for Robert Earl Counsel, who's known as Kinetic Justice. He's featured in the film. We interviewed him about 10 years ago. He is so often for actually for years, has been held in solitary confinement. We're also joined here in New York by the film's co-directors, Andrew Jarecki and Charlotte Kaufman. The two also work together on the HBO series, The Jinx. Andrew's also the director of the Oscar-nominated documentary, Capturing the Freedmans. Welcome all to Democracy Now! Andrew, let's begin with you. Lay out the Alabama Solution, what you found when you went to Alabama, and how did you get in these prisons?
Well, it was kind of a miracle that we got access to the prisons, because prisons in the U.S. are kind of black sites. And, you know, we drive by these prisons and we see a little sign at the side of the road and we assume, well, whatever's happening back there, if it was really terrible, I guess I'd hear about it. But because journalists aren't allowed in these prisons, you actually don't hear about it. So I was interested in the Alabama prison system, and I took a sort of road trip to just go down there. And I met this prison chaplain, the first black prison chaplain in the history of Alabama. And he said, well, if you're interested, come in and, you know, you'll volunteer. And I said, well, we're filmmakers. They're not going to let us in there with cameras. And he said, well, just come in and we'll distribute food packages and meet the men and you'll see what's going on. And then when we went in, we managed to establish a relationship with a warden who said, well, you can come in and film like this revival meeting, which is a very beautiful Christian celebration. And when we went in to film that, which was unusual, the men started whispering to us that there were really terrible things going on that we weren't allowed to see. And they were curating our visit. And then eventually we get sort of nosy and we get thrown out. And it was after that that we discovered that there were sort of a network of men inside who had access to contraband cell phones. And there were these incredible leaders of a nonviolent protest movement who wanted to speak and had been speaking for years about it. And so that became a sort of a collaboration in a way where we were doing an investigation with their help.
I mean, this is astounding, Charlotte. Most of what we're looking at is cell phone footage taken by and narrated by the prisoners themselves. Where do they get the cell phones?
Well, many of the cell phones, you know, from our investigation observation, come in through the guards.
These are contraband cell phones.
Yes, yeah, and they've been in the system since around 2013, and the men in our film have been using them as a way to overcome the secrecy that shrouds all prisons in the U.S. since that time. But it is interesting that you know, a lot of the phones are brought in by guards or with the permission of guards, even though they're then being used to document and expose things that the guards may be doing or the administration may be doing.
So let's go to a clip from the Alabama Solution. This is you, our guest, filmmaker Charlotte Kaufman, receiving a call from Melvin Ray, who's a prisoner from prison.
Would a regular phone call be better?
No, because it does not allow us to just be ourselves, you know. When we present our stories, we want to present our whole self, not just our voice. We're in these walled-off secret societies. These are state institutions. But it's one of the only state institutions that the public or the media has no access to. How can a journalist go into a war zone but can't go into a prison in the United States of America?
The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that wardens can effectively deny journalists access to prisons by citing safety and security concerns.
Like, I can witness a murder. We could be all sitting there and witness a murder. And the media can't even come on the state property.
That's, again, a clip from the Oscar-nominated Alabama Solution. Andrew Jarecki, what you show with these films, I mean, you have this prisoner saying, I could witness a murder. Journalists cannot come in. It is astounding to think about this. They can go to war, but they can't come into prisons run by the U.S. government.
Well, there's no question that the, you know, any authoritarian administration does not want you to see what's going on inside. That's one of the reasons why Alex Pretty got killed, right? It's because he was using a cell phone, which they then described as a weapon. So when you have a secretive system, they can't really continue to do what they're doing if there's enough public pressure, which is one of the reasons why Alabama is so anxious about this film. The governor didn't come out and say anything about it for around a year. And then when the film got nominated, she immediately came out with a statement sort of discrediting the film and saying, actually, she's been the best governor running the best, you know, best effort to try to improve prisons of any governor in the history of Alabama. Interesting distinction.
But I would also say it's not just Alabama. It's all across the country. We spend $80 billion a year on prisons and jails and incarcerate 2 million people. And yet the public's not allowed to see in and evaluate whether it is the system is fulfilling its mandate. And so I think what Melvin is trying to tell us is, you know, we should be demanding transparency and evaluating whether these systems are actually serving us or causing great harm.
I want to go to another clip from the Alabama Solution.
Roll it. Roll it. Roll it.
The clip begins with text messages from a prisoner named Melvin Ray writing, I have some information for you. Word is an inmate got beaten real bad at Donaldson Prison, sent UAB Hospital ICU. Melvin said the man's name was Stephen Davis.
We're looking for Stephen Davis. What do you think, he's in the ICU?
We're looking in the hospital right now. Someone has a cell phone, and the elevator doors open, and they're going down the hallway. They're clearly looking for the room where Stephen is. And then they see a room that says Davis, and they look through the curtains. The curtains are closed.
Hey, someone.
I'm personally listening.
Not a lot.
If you could go out to the waiting room, or I can help you by calling, but I'd prefer you not stand in front of
me. Okay, sure.
Thanks.
Sure. We should find his family.
Charlotte, that was you saying you were looking through the curtain and saying it's a body bag?
Yes, Andrew and I were both at the hospital that day. And the reason, you know, we got this text message that informed us that someone had been beaten and taken to the hospital. And the reason we immediately went to the hospital is because from our investigation and our research, we knew that often the prison system doesn't tell family members about what happened or doesn't report anything publicly until sometimes weeks later. And that by that point, the story of what actually occurred can be very muddled. So in that scene, we're trying to stay on top of the information and begin an investigation into what we find out is the killing of a man at the hands of a correctional officer.
Let's go to another clip from the Alabama Solution. In this clip, an anonymous prison staff member calls Sandy. She's the mother of Stephen Davis, who was killed when incarcerated at Donaldson Correctional Facility. She wears oxygen, and so she has to take some time to get this call.
Later that evening, an unidentified staff member from Donaldson Prison calls Sandy.
Hello? I'm sorry. I'm on oxygen, so I had to take a minute there.
Okay, I understand.
Who's this?
Well, don't, you know, I'm just, I know you're grieving and mourning, and I want to tell you that your son was beaten to death by an officer. That was a murder. You know, they sweep stuff underneath the rug all the time about this.
I called the warden this afternoon. An hour later, there was a statement on the news that he rushed out of his cell with two homemade weapons and attacked
a plastic knife. They always come up with something to justify excess brutality and use of force.
Andrew Jarecki, we're watching Sandy, Davis's mom, Stephen Davis's mom, get this call. Who is it from? Where she's told her son has been murdered by guards.
Yeah, I mean, we know who the call came from, and we were just being discreet in the film because it's very rare to have a whistleblower who's on the staff at the prison tell somebody the truth of what happened. But I think this is a person who has a higher character than a lot of other people who witness things like this in the prison, and he felt compelled to reach out to the mother of somebody who he had learned had been murdered at the hands of corrections officers. So he was seeing the story that the prison was putting out, which was that Stephen had attacked guards, which is absurd, and immediately felt like he had to call the mother and say, look, at least you should know this.
I mean, the picture, the photograph, and Charlotte, you can talk about this photograph they have of Stephen Davis's head, who took it, how horrifying it is.
Yeah, Stephen's brother, Brandon, took a photo when, as he explains, the guards were out back sleeping at the hospital because while Stephen was in ICU, the prison officials made sure there was a presence at the hospital to let the family know and to let Stephen know, just in case he woke up, that they were watching. And they told Sandy and Stephen's brother, you cannot come into the room with Stephen. But while the guards were away, Stephen's brother snuck a photo. And I'll also say we met Stephen's dad as well. And the dad, when we were initially going to speak to the dad, he said, are you from the news? Because the prison told us that if we speak to the news, they won't give us back the body. So this idea of sort of hiding what's happening in the prisons and even hiding bodies, is very striking.
You talk about the staff at the hospital. Let's go to another clip of the Alabama Solution where we hear from former correctional officers Stacy George and Quante Cockrell. The clip ends with the prisoners themselves.
Correctional officers should be the most reliable, trustworthy. You really want people that'll do the right thing when nobody's watching. But in Alabama, you don't have that.
Every day I thought I should be participating in this. There's just so much stuff happening there. So now there's a lot of officers leaving.
Sometimes we have one officer for 200-300 inmates. With the low staffing and the mandatory overtime, you've got officers that look like zombies.
Now look at this man in the queue sleep.
That's the queue. Ain't no police in the queue. None. Ain't no police in the dorm. Nowhere in the dorm. How do we get out?
Outside. Another clip from the Alabama Solution. I want to bring in our third guest, Tiffany Johnson Cole. Tiffany, you are a civil rights and civil litigation attorney. You're also a childhood friend and attorney for Robert Earl Counsel, also known as Kinetic Justice. We spoke to him 10 years ago, and we'll get to him in a minute. But talk about the lawsuit that you have brought.
Most recently, well, we had an initial lawsuit in 2021 wherein Robert Earl was assaulted by guards. And we since settled a portion of that lawsuit against the guards and actually went to a jury trial and won in Jefferson County against the medical provider. The most recent lawsuit, though, is a temporary restraining order and preliminary injunction that deals with the transfer of Robert Earl, Raul, and Melvin between January 12th and 13th to the L dorm, which is located at Kilby, which is considered a highly restrictive area often associated with intimidation. They were transferred between January 12th and 13th for what we believe was protected speech by people they associate with on the outside. And so that lawsuit is still pending.
Mm. I want to go to the backdrop of the Free Alabama movement, Andrew, going back 10 years to this strike that they led across the state. In fact, it went beyond that.
Well, I think it's most notable that these men have always observed peaceful protest movements, whether that's a labor stoppage, because, you know, that can be powerful. Alabama has $450 million a year in unpaid labor that they benefit from. So if the men undertake a work stoppage, it's a real threat to
the way
the system.
You mean they're sort of running the prison? I mean, they're being directed, but...
Yes, but way beyond that. I think the average person thinks, okay, well, somebody is in prison, maybe they're supposed to sweep up or they're supposed to serve a meal or something. I think what shocks people is that they're farmed out not just to the governor's mansion, they work on road crews, they work on construction for the state, and beyond that, they're leased out to McDonald's and Burger King and the Hyundai Parts Company and the Budweiser distributorship. So it really is very...
And how much are they paid?
Well, in the film, you see one of the people who works in sanitation is being paid $2 a day, and they're charging the state of Alabama, the Department of Corrections is charging, you know, $10 or more per hour for these people. So it's a very, very lucrative thing. And the other thing the men will do sometimes is go on hunger strike. And so it's always peaceful, and yet the way the state deals with it is always through violence.
So I want to bring in Robert Earl's voice, also known as Kinetic Justice. About 10 years ago in 2016, we spoke to Kinetic Justice, co-founder of the Free Alabama Movement, about the prisoner strike.
These strikes are our method for challenging mass incarceration. As we understand that the prison system is a continuation of the slave system, and which in all instances is an economical system. Therefore, for the reform and changes that we've been fighting for in Alabama, we've tried petitioning through the courts. We've tried to get in touch with legislators and so forth, and we haven't had any recourse. Therefore, we understood that our incarceration was pretty much about our labor and the money that was being generated in the prison system. Therefore, we began organizing around our labor and used it as a means and a method in order to bring about reform in the Alabama prison system.
That's Kinetic Justice Robert Earl. Back in 2016 on Democracy Now!, he was at Holman, I think, in Alabama at the time. Tiffany Johnson Cole, you grew up with him. I mean, he is a leader of this Alabama free movement.
Yes, he and I grew up together. And as a result of what he experienced when he became incarcerated, he and Melvin and other incarcerated persons joined together to create the Free Alabama Movement to basically call attention to the conditions that are inhumane, that are being carried out in the name of the state. And so both Melvin and Robert Earl are extremely intelligent, strategic and legal minds. They have studied the law. It's always interesting to me how we can go back and debate some of the legal theories and some of their pleadings and some of their filings, but they have pretty much put themselves in harm's way in an effort to bring about change in a system that is truly cruel and inhumane.
I want to go to the title of the Alabama Solution. This is Alabama Governor Kay Ivey.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Please be seated. You heard me say this before, and I'll say it again. This is an Alabama problem that must have an Alabama solution. I look forward to working with each of you to solve it. I've asked Commissioner Dunn to build three new prisons that will transition our facilities from warehousing inmates to rehabilitating people.
So that's Alabama Governor Kay Ivey. And this, Andrew, is you questioning Alabama Attorney General Steve Marshall.
I mean, I think we have a strategic plan in place. There's an argument that there is some systemic problem within all of our facilities, and I wholeheartedly disagree with that. We dare defend our rights. That is a motto of the state that I think matters. We have the opportunity to push back against what we think is an overreach of the Department of Justice. We don't necessarily embrace the fact that Washington, D.C. has all the answers. We want to be able to do it ourselves in ways that we think make sense for Alabama. And in fact, the governor's plan demonstrates that.
That's the Alabama Attorney General as we wrap up, Andrew Jarecki.
Yeah. I mean, that experience of talking to him was just remarkable because it's a kind of government speak that is devoid of the humanity of it, right? Whether he's visited the Alabama prisons or not, sort of irrelevant. He is the person that's running the justice system in that state, and he's obviously doesn't believe that there's a problem.
30 seconds, solitary confinement, who's in, who's out right now?
Melvin Ray has been released. Robert Earl Counsel and Raul Poole are still in. And what I would just say is we made this film over 7 years, but the issue in Alabama's prison is still very urgent and very current. Since 2019, 1,500 people have died. And as you can see, they are threatened by voices that speak up. They are an authoritarian power that wants to quell dissent. That is what some of the people in our film are dealing with right now. And so I hope that people will watch, go to our website. There are ways to take action.
The website
is www.thealabamasolution.com.
Charlotte Kaufman and Andrew Jarecki, co-directors of the Oscar-nominated Alabama Solution. Attorney Tiffany Johnson Cole joining us from Alabama. Thank you so much for this incredible, epic work. I'm Amy Goodman.